It's Friday, April 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Syria's cessation of hostilities becomes more fragile. North Korea attempts another missile launch.
Its actions in the South China Sea will have essentially been deemed out of sync with international law by an international court.
China faces greater pressure at sea. Also ahead, fit for a king, the massive fortune of Prince. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Syria UN envoy Staffan de Mistura has called on the United States and Russia at the highest level to intervene and salvage the two-month-old cessation of hostilities in Syria that he described as barely alive. De Mistura, who has presided over the now-stalled proximity talks between the government and opposition in Geneva, said the uptick in violence cannot be ignored.
We cannot ignore that, and we have not ignored it. We cannot ignore the fact that during these talks, we have been having incidents one after the other. In the last 48 hours, we have had an average of one Syrian killed every 25 minutes, one Syrian wounded every 13 minutes. But what we need to do and to hear is that the cessation of hostilities is salvaged and that the cessation of hostilities is saved from a total collapse. It's still there. It's still there because many areas is still there, but is in great danger.
The UN envoy said the next round of Geneva talks can be meaningful only if the ceasefire implemented in late February is brought back to the level we saw in February and March. He said the legacies of Presidents Obama and Putin are linked to the success of the peace effort. The opposition suspended its formal participation last week after what it called repeated government violations of the ceasefire. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype de Mistura has some leverage given the backing of his efforts by both the U.S. and Russian governments.
To a point, there has been some progress. There has been a diminution of the violence. There has been some humanitarian aid getting through to various communities, etc. But it's really on this knife edge where violence is increasing in some areas, some of it directed at, for example, Islamic State or a Nusra Front, which were excluded from the process. But some of it seems to be, in the North Aleppo area, for example, seems to be still directed at some of the less fundamentalist groups. His problem is that there's no real opposition. There are people who have attended the conferences in Europe who are put forward as secular groups, as friends of the West, if you like, but their capacity, their influence is limited. So he's working with a very weak foundation, if you like. I think the real danger for him is that the Russians and the Americans are going to start pushing their allies, their two sort of sets of allies, if you like, in the region to increase the violence. So we've heard Obama say that he's going to be sending more troops to the region. The Russians seem to have increased the level of violence, their level of activity in the region. So there's this point at which the Americans and the Russians in particular need to somehow or other listen to Mistura and say, okay, we'll just ease off here.
The reports keep mounting about a military buildup in northern Syria, coupled with heavy fighting, with mounting civilian casualties. The Associated Press reporting some 200 civilians killed in just the past week, nearly half of them around Aleppo, where there's been shelling and airstrikes. What is this fighting all about?
Aleppo is a central issue in this conflict. The government wants to retake or at least have Aleppo at its mercy, I think. There's also the issue there that despite some reasonable gains, I suppose, on the part of some of the rebel forces, the government, I think, has been led to, especially after Palmyra, has been led to think that it's winning. And if you're winning, why should you bother negotiating with these people who, after all, have no real standing? And so I think this is really important for the Russians to come in and say, well, okay, We've saved your bacon. We're going to ensure that you continue, but you've got to give a little bit.
UN Envoy de Mistura, who hopes the talks can resume next month, said on the key issue of Syria's political future, there is a clear understanding that a political transition should be overseen by a new, credible, and inclusive government, which will be replacing the present governance arrangement. But he did not discuss the fate of President Bashar al-Assad, whose removal is a key objective to the opposition. Well, we now turn to the topic of North Korea's failed missile launch, which we'll explore a little bit more in our program. We have social media reporter G. Abby Lee here in the studio to share what people are saying about it online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So the information came out of the South Korean military. What's the public reaction like?
I saw a lot of people making fun of the failure and referring to the missiles as candles on South Korea's internet portal, Naver. I also went over to the Joseon-Ilbo website, South Korea's most popular conservative publication. That being said, it's no surprise that the most liked response reads like this. The pro-Pyongyang politicians and activists must be disappointed. Another person wrote, it looks like a historic decision-making time is near.
I see. And the news is making headlines around the world.
That's right. Al Jazeera English is one of the many media outlets reporting on it. And on Facebook, it wrote, if confirmed, it would be the second such failure in weeks. Other replies are also mainly critical of the North nuclear program.
Well, I did see Republican presidential contender Donald Trump expressing his opinion Wednesday on North Korea and U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, that's right. He did. And the right-leaning Fox News tweeted about it yesterday. Quoting Trump, it tweeted, Obama watches helplessly as North Korea increases its aggression and expands nuclear reach. Replies to that tweet generally criticized Trump's statement as illogical using hashtag #NeverFacts.
Well, what are some of the hashtags that people can use to keep themselves posted on the story?
You can use either hashtag North Korea or hashtag DPRK. That's North Korea's official name. Now, I also want to mention the UN Security Council is weighing a response to the failed missile test, but there aren't any tweets about it yet. Jim?
All right. Thank you for the wrap-up, G. She tweets for our program's account at @VOA_IE and from her own account at @GAbbyLee. And you can follow me on Twitter at @VOAStevenson. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Continuing on now from social media reaction, North Korea's apparent test firing of an intermediate-range missile had crashed seconds after takeoff in what appears to be the second such failure in a matter of weeks. South Korea's defense ministry reported the failed launch Thursday, and it says North Korea is likely trying to launch a new mid-range missile which could be used to reach military bases in Asia and in the Pacific Ocean. The launch comes as South Korea and the United States conduct annual joint military drills that North Korea has labeled a provocation. Brian Padden is our VOA correspondent in Seoul, and he tells my International Edition colleague Susan Yaki the launch is drawing more criticism against North Korea.
The international community is quite united in opposing North Korea's efforts to acquire advanced nuclear weapons capability. Since January, after North Korea conducted its fifth nuclear test, as we all know, the United Nations imposed tough new sanctions on the Kim Jong-un government, and those sanctions could get even stronger or more strongly enforced, or more sanctions approved if North Korea continues with these types of provocations, and most specifically, if it conducts a fifth nuclear test, which South Korean authorities say it is the North is prepared to do any day now.
This comes right before a high-profile party meeting next week in Pyongyang. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, and this is part of the motivation we understand for all of these activities recently is kind of to enhance the image of the young Kim Jong-un, the young leader of North Korea, in advance of this rare party congress meeting, the first time in 36 years that such a meeting is going to occur. Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, did not think highly of these official congresses and functions, and he did not have them during his time. So it is a change of legislative structure that Kim Jong-un wants to rebuild the party apparatus, wants to be seen as a head, wants to have that stature as head of the party in this conference to legitimize perhaps his own rule. What we are standing by to learn is that he will likely speak at this conference. We want to hear what he has to say. We'll be listening to see how exactly he responds to the sanctions in this speech, how he responds to the international community's calling for North Korea to give up its nuclear arsenal and come back to the bargaining table to talk about security assurances and economic aid in response for giving up those nuclear weapons.
VOA's Brian Patton reporting from Seoul. U.S. lawmakers are calling on the Obama administration to conduct more frequent freedom of navigation operations close to artificial islands developed by China, those, of course, in the disputed waters of the South China Sea. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker of Tennessee, expressed his view Wednesday ahead of testimony by U.S. Secretary of State, Deputy, that is, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Neither the rhetoric nor the freedom of navigation operations have deterred or slowed down China's land reclamation activities, including the stationing of military-related assets on these artificial islands. Moreover, many experts assess it is increasingly likely that Beijing will declare an air defense identification zone in the South China Sea. And China could undertake further destabilizing actions if the International Tribunal ruling, as expected, goes against Chinese interest. As I've said previously, I fully appreciate the complexity of the U.S.-China relationship and the need for constructive engagement on a number of issues important to both Washington and Beijing. But merely managing differences with China is not a successful formula, particularly when such management cedes U.S. influence and places American interest at risk in the Indo-Pacific and beyond.
Blinken said the number of so-called freedom of navigation operations carried out by the U.S. military in the South China Sea has increased in recent years, and they will continue. Recent news reports, notably in the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal, say China may be considering new island construction beyond the Spratly Islands. Anki Panda is an associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication The Diplomat. He says he's not an alarmist when it comes to the Scarborough Shoal.
The biggest reason is that the features in the Spratly Islands that China has turned into artificial islands over the past few years were previously occupied by Beijing since at least the 1980s. Scarborough Shoal is very different. It was previously administered by the Philippines and was coercively seized. It wasn't a previously held Chinese feature, so staging any reclamation activities there, for example, would be incredibly provocative. And, you know, I would also add the context here is that case that's pending at The Hague at the Permanent Court of Arbitration between the Philippines and China is expected to reach a verdict in early June. And when that verdict comes around, most analysts, myself included, expect that to go against China and in the Philippines' favor. And essentially, Beijing will face some reputational costs. Its actions in the South China Sea will have essentially been deemed out of sync with international law by an international court. So it seems unlikely to me that they would choose to go forward with reclamation of Scarborough Shoal, but China doesn't show any signs immediately of at least stopping its activities.
Ankit Panda, associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication, The Diplomat. Wall Street Journal quotes Nanjing University security analyst Zhou Feng as saying that he could not rule out Chinese construction of a lighthouse or a maritime monitoring post on Scarborough Shoal. But sizable land reclamation would, he says, be out of the question. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, if you like to shop, perhaps South Africa is the destination for you. South African shoppers flocked to the opening Thursday of one of Africa's largest malls in metropolitan Johannesburg, despite rising unemployment and slowing economic growth. The Mall of Africa spans about 140,000 square feet. It registered 68,000 visitors by 1 p.m. local time, according to a spokesman for the mall's owners. They didn't expect that high a number, but they got them. Before the opening of stores, lines of people, some stretching for more than 100 meters, waited outside international stores that recently launched in South Africa, including fashion retailer H&M, Starbucks, and the donut shop Krispy Kreme. Well, a week has passed since music icon Prince died at his home near Minneapolis, Minnesota, and some information has begun now to trickle out about his death and apparently large estate. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald stops by with more. The world still mourns the loss of Prince, but we have learned a few things about him. And one of the interesting things is he did not leave a will, but he left an awful lot of stuff.
He sure did. Hey, Jim, this is partly owing to his deep-seated distrust of contracts. He had terrible experiences with record labels. He famously wrote the word slave on his cheek in the 1990s when he was battling with Warner Brothers Records. Now, on Tuesday, his sister Tyka Nelson filed an emergency motion to have an administrator gather and protect Prince's assets. Bremer Bank has been appointed to fill that role. Prince was married twice, and he and his wife, Maytay, suffered some miscarriages. But as far as we know, he does not have any surviving children. The trust also needs to locate Prince's heirs, and as of now, they include Tyka and five half-siblings. Lawyers who handle intellectual property say it may take years to determine the value of Prince's estate, and we, the public, may never hear about it. Right now, it's estimated to be worth well in excess of $100 million. People have thrown various figures around, up to and including $300 million. Prince worked with many lawyers, accountants, and business managers over the years, and this just further complicates the process. He would apparently drop them at the slightest pretext and then have somebody else sign up. So there are a lot of channels that this has to go through.
It's really fascinating. The songs in the vault, we understand there are quite a few, and we could end up, once they get this sorted out, with Prince albums coming out for years to come.
It may well be a Jimi Hendrix-type situation where there were several posthumous albums issued. He was very prolific. He released 39 albums over the course of his 38-year recording career, and apparently he has hundreds more songs in the vaults. And so their worth will depend on when and how they're released.
One, two, three.
That's the latest on Prince's estate situation. Meanwhile, a law enforcement official told CNN that authorities found prescription opioid medication in Prince's possession and at his home. They want to determine who prescribed the pills and if they were improperly prescribed. Entertainment Tonight is reporting that Prince used the pain medication Percocet to treat hip and ankle pain beginning in 2006. He underwent hip replacement surgery in 2010. Prince was 5 feet 2 inches, and he frequently wore high-heeled shoes. And his former fiancée and musical collaborator Sheila E. remarked that he was in constant pain because he would often jump from stage risers during his concerts. And this put tremendous pressure on his ankles and hips. And so apparently Prince lived his later years in constant pain, and that must have been just horrible.
Always with us is Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host. You can follow him on Twitter at Ray on the Hits. And Ray, they can join you every week for the Countdown at
VOA 1.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
No doubt much more to come on Prince through the weeks and months ahead, and we'll keep you up to date. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our engineer is Carl Starling. Director is Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian Ministry of Justice has suspended the activities of the Mezhlis of the Crimean Tatar people, an institution registered with the Ukrainian government and operating in Ukrainian territory, putting it on the Russian government's list of extremist organizations. The Mezhlis has long been a representative body for the Crimean Tatar population. It has also served as an important independent voice in preserving their culture and protecting them from discrimination. State Department spokesperson John Kirby called on Russia to reverse the Ministry of Justice's recent decision to designate the Crimean Tatar Mezhlis as an extremist organization, and the decision by de facto authorities in Crimea to suspend this democratic institution. This move against the Mezhlis is the latest in a series of abuses perpetrated by the de facto authorities against those in Crimea who oppose the Russian occupation and attempted annexation, including Crimean Tatars and the members of other ethnic and religious minorities in Crimea. According to the latest State Department human rights report, over the past year, Russian security services engaged in an extensive campaign of intimidation to suppress dissent and opposition to the occupation that employed kidnappings, disappearances, physical abuse, and deportations in Crimea. More broadly, Russian authorities engaged in a widespread campaign to suppress free speech and media in Crimea. They refused to register Crimean media and news organizations, preventing them from operating legally. Security services also detained and abused journalists and threatened them with prosecution for opposing the occupation. On April 19th, Russian authorities detained several journalists in Crimea and raided 5 offices of media outlets on the peninsula. One journalist, Mykola Semina, was detained for allegedly speaking out against Russia's occupation. This is the latest in a pattern of attempts to muzzle free speech in Crimea. The United States condemns the ongoing abuses in Crimea and again calls on Russia to end its occupation of Crimea. Sanctions related to Crimea will remain in place until Russia ends its occupation and returns the peninsula to Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.